This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Fortuitous that tonight, later on, as many of you know, we'll be celebrating a siyum for the ladies' shiur that has just completed studying the Sefer of Iyov. That the medrash that I'm talking about here this evening is based on a posuk one from one of the closing chapters of Iyov. The medrash on our sedra goes on the statement in Iyov, "Vatigzar Omer vayokim loch," where Iyov is accused by his friends of not being on a sufficiently high spiritual level, for if he was, you could make declarations and Hashem would carry them out, say Iyov's friends to him. The fact that you feel yourself to be such a function of your environment, so unable to control your environment, so controlled by your environment, is because of your own inadequacies, because of your own lack of stature. If you would only be a greater person, you would be able to decree and Hashem would fulfill your decrees. And there are a couple of midrashim that discuss that. One of them is the following: Omer Rabbi Yeshua de Sichna b'shem Rabbi Levi, Kol Mashe Gozar Moshe Hiski Makadosh Baruch Hu Imo. Everything that Moshe decreed, the Ribbono Shel Olam accepted. And we see here a further example of a concept that we've been discussing over the past several weeks in a different dimension. We've discussed over the past weeks how it is possible for man to create a situation where he, so to say, makes God indebted to him, despite the fact that there is no way that we can repay the Ribbono Shel Olam, that we can repay God for all the goodness He's given us. There's no way that we can repay God even for the goodness He gives to us in one fraction of a second, because even in a fraction of a moment of life, the potential achievements are infinite. There is no limit to how much can be achieved in one moment of life. And therefore we don't have it within us. There is no measurable way to express gratitude to the Ribbono Shel Olam even for one moment of life, how much more so for a whole lifetime of goodness and of good things. Nevertheless, there is a mechanism which we've been discussing of creating a situation where where God, so to say, becomes indebted to us, where when we meet with the Ribbono Shel Olam after 120 years on this earth, we can approach Him as a creditor approaches a debtor, rather than as a debtor approaches as a creditor, and we can look him in the eye, so to say. And we discussed in that, which also ties to the end of the book of Iyov, how necessary it was, we see in the book of Iyov, for Hashem to create a hierarchy of power within the world. Because without that hierarchy of power, it wouldn't be possible to appreciate the power of God, and it wouldn't be able to be possible to appreciate the power of man. Power is not of any value when it's expressed over weaklings, when it's expressed over powerless beings. But when we realize that human beings are capable of exerting influence and power over powerful over powerful creations, then one begins to realize the enormity of the creation and the enormity of the capacity of the human being. But we go so far as to say that it is even theoretically possible for the human being, so to say, to dominate the Ribbono Shel Olam, to overpower the Ribbono Shel Olam, to overpower God Himself. And here we see an aspect of that. Kol Mashe Gozar Moshe Hiski Makadosh Baruch Hu Imo. Man can decree and God will obey. Where do we find such a religion? Where do we find such a philosophy? Where do we find any way of thinking that attributes such greatness to man? Man can decree and God will obey. That it is possible in a sense for a human being to reach a level of Vatigzor Omer Vayokim Loch, where you through an utterance can decree, a man can decree, and the Ribbono Shel Olam will fulfill that decree. This chazal appears in various gemaras and in various places in the medrash in slightly different forms and with many different examples. Here the medrash brings two examples. Ketzad, for example. The first example is the most fascinating of all. Lo yomar le'akadosh baruch hu lishbor es haluchos. The Ribbono Shel Olam never instructed Moshe to shatter the luchos, to shatter the tablets of stone. God entrusted Moshe with the most precious possession that he could acquire. Moshe had struggled for 40 days and 40 nights of intense dedication, of intense self-sacrifice, almost giving his life, virtually giving his life, in order to achieve the reception of those luchos, of those tablets. He gets the tablets. What is he meant to do with them? He's meant to take them down. He's meant to put them in the Oren. He's meant to teach them to the Bnei Yisrael. This is the Torah. The purpose of the whole creation, the ultimate, finally the creation has reached its apex, has found itself fit to receive the Torah. Hashem hands the Torah physically over to Moshe. Moshe receives it in his two hands. What does he do with them? They're irreplaceable. Imagine a work of art. Nothing compared to the luchos. Work of art, some artist made, has a message, means something. But the Torah that has everything included in it, that means everything, a one-off piece, given by God to man, and Moshe off his own bat decides to destroy it before he gets down. Nobody told him to do it. Holach Moshe v'shibram me'atzme. Moshe went and shattered them himself. Uminayin shehiski makadosh baruch imo. And how do we know that Hashem agreed with him? Dichtiv asher shibarto. When Hashem says that refers to the luchos which you broke, that word asher, the Medrash learns, is from yasher. Yasher kochecho sheshibarta. Ayusher koch, Moshe. It was the right thing to do. Moshe takes upon himself such a decision to destroy the Torah without being told to do so. And Hashem agrees. From there we see Vatigzor Oimer Vayokimloch. The power of the tzaddik, the power of the leader, the power of the Talmid Chochem, to decree, to make a halachic decision which is binding even on the Ribbono Shel Olam. And we need to analyze that episode first before we go on to the second episode. And we need to query, why then did Hashem give the luchos to Moshe? If he agreed that they had to be broken before they were going to reach the people, why give it to him? Why give him something that he has to break? It's all very well. It's amazing enough that Moshe broke it without being told to do it. But by the fact that he was given the luchos, surely that was enough of a sign that he wasn't meant to break them? And but we see not so. Hashem congratulates him. Thank you for breaking them. Why give them to him to be broken? Who would do such a thing? Take this one-off piece of art with... invaluable, no figure can be attached to it, and give it to somebody with the intention that somebody should break them and destroy it. And although Hashem replaced them, the replacement was not the same as the original. That question is asked by the Tiferet Tziyun. It's asked by the Tiferet Tziyun on the Medrash, similar Medrash that appears in Bamidbar, in Parsha Yutes. And the Tiferet Tzion answers, because that act gave the Chachomim the power to use their own decision-making process to go as far as they want in the application of the Torah. Had God withheld the Torah from Moshe, he would have held the power of decision-making from mankind. Hashem wanted to give it to Moshe and say to Moshe, you do with it as you see fit, without giving him any indication of what's meant to be done with it. I'm giving you the Torah to do with as you wish. If you, Moshe Rabbeinu, feel it has to be shattered, then shatter it. You decide. Because from this moment onwards, lo yibashamayim hi, from this moment onwards, the Torah is no longer in heaven. From this moment onwards, the Torah is given to man. Being given to man means not just that you can now study it. Being given to man means that you can now dominate the Torah, that you can now control the Torah, that you can be creative with the Torah. This is not a passive exercise. You're not going to become mere recipients of the Torah. You're going to become masters of the Torah. You're going to determine the direction of the Torah. In the Torah are all the guidelines you need in its interpretation and in its application. But you're going to decide on that interpretation. You're going to decide on that application. So Moshe decides to destroy the Torah. Why does he do it? Where does he get that authority from? How does he work that out? So the Gemara tells us in Yevamos Tassamad Bezamad Aleph and various other places too, the Gemara says, Modorash, what was Moshe's calculation? What was Moshe's halachic decision? Omar, he said to himself, Uma Pesach shehu echod mishish meyusu shloshes ve-mitzvis. The Korban Pesach, which is only one of 613 mitzvahs, the sacrifice that has to be brought before Pesach. Omra Torah, the Torah says, Kol ben nechal lo yechal bo, any estranged person shall not eat from that korban. And Rashi explains that a ben nechal means a person shenismachru maisov, a person whose deeds have become estranged from the value system of the Torah. So such a person, a mumar for example, may not eat of the korban Pesach. Here in my hands I have the entire Torah, all 613 mitzvahs, including that one. Be Yisrael mumorim, and the Jews are dancing around an idol. Alachas kama v'kama, kal v'chomer, how much more so? Shall I not allow them to have the Torah? If they're not allowed to participate in one of 613 of the mitzvahs, how much more so are they not permitted to participate in the whole lot? That was Moshe's rabbinic logic that brought him to the conclusion that he was entitled and in fact obligated to destroy the luchos rather than to bring them down. We'll analyze the accuracy of that logic in a moment, but before that it's interesting to see the confidence in the logic. That whatever the accuracy of that logic was, Moshe felt sufficiently confident to be able to take the luchos and destroy them on the basis of human logic, and he did not refer the question back to the Ribbono Shel Olam, nor did he ask a Rebbe in some distant land. He worked it out, al pi halacha, this was the thing that has to be done, and was willing on the basis of that halachic decision to do whatever needed to be done, even the destruction of the whole Torah, without the knowledge that Hashem would replace it. He felt there was just no way based on this. The Torah itself demands of him that destruction. How good is that rabbinic logic? It's shockingly poor. How can you make such a comparison? It's true there are certain mitzvahs which a mumer is not allowed to participate in, such as a Korban Pesach. But there are other mitzvahs in which he's allowed to participate in. So we see it's got nothing to do with the quantity of mitzvahs, some yes, some no. And more so, Tosfos asks, Afagav the Kavachomer Gomer, Inze Kavachomer Gomer, this is not a very good Kavachomer, says Tosfos. There are two mitnei tzivo pam echod levatel yevatel loilam. So that's on another issue. Tosfos says the following: Ein ze kavachom egomu the shani pesach mishim the kodshim. Pesach, the korban pesach, follows specific rules of kodshim. This applies to the rules of the Beis Hamikdash, where certain people can participate and certain people can't. Avol kol haTorah kulo, but the body of Torah. This is educational material. Who needs educational material most of all? Deviant people. So the Torah is more appropriate to these people than to anybody else. How can he withhold the body of educational material from Klal Yisrael? Because they're misbehaving. All the more reason to give them the Torah and to teach them the Torah. They didn't have the Torah yet. So how can Moshe make such a kavachomer, asks Tosfos? What kind of rabbinic logic is this? And Tosfos doesn't answer it. And I'm actually indebted to you, as I've often said before, because I mentioned to somebody just over an hour ago that my shiur wasn't yet prepared. And this is the kind of Tosfos, if you don't have an answer to, if you don't understand, you can't sleep at night. This is something so fundamental, and Tosfos doesn't seem to be particularly worried. Tosfos just leaves it, just makes a passing comment. Not very good logic. Not very good logic, thank you very much. On the basis of that not very good logic, Moshe takes it upon himself to destroy the Torah. And Tosfos just carries on as if nothing else happened. That's the kind of Tosfos one can't sleep at night. And just over half an hour ago, I turned to the Ribbono Shel Olam in my usual fashion and I said that I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight. That's fine. I guess I deserve it. But I've got nothing else to say in the shiur tonight. I've got to tell them this Tosfos. Why should they not sleep tonight? What have they done wrong? So for their sake, you'd better give me the answer. And there is an answer, which we'll discuss in a moment. But we see here the power of this rabbinic logic. There's the other famous case. where Rabbi Elozer and the Chachomim are arguing in Bava Metzia Daf Nun Tes Amud Beis. Tano, we learned. But Oysa Hayom on that day, Heishiv Rabbi Eliezer called to Shuvah Sheva Oilam. Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachomim were sitting and debating a particular halachic issue, and whatever question was posed to Rabbi Eliezer, he answered comfortably, with all the most brilliant answers in the world. But they didn't accept his decision. Amalayim, eventually out of total frustration and in total confidence, Rabbi Eliezer says to them, Im halacha kamoisi churuv ze yuchich. Says Rabbi Eliezer to them, you know, these are days when people are most impressed by all sorts of mystical things. If you won't accept my halachic reason, how about a mystical argument? If I'm right, let this carob trees take 100 years to grow, so you can imagine that they're pretty firm once they've grown, let it move. Just let's see it move from its place. The choruv tree, the carob tree, moved itself 100 amos, 100 cubits, that's about, what was that, 60 meters, quite a long way. There was another version there that said it was 400 meters. It was 400 amis. How much does that stand? 240 meters. Amruloi, ein bevin raya min achorav. They burst out laughing. They said, where on earth have you heard in the Beis HaMedrash where intellectual people are sitting and talking about Torah to bring proof from a carob tree? Ever heard of such nonsense? Totally unimpressed. Can you imagine today if somebody did that? You'd be a... People would be running, there'd be queues around the block to get brochas from him already. And they would be paying thousands of rand per brocha. Make a carob tree and move. The Chachomim are totally unimpressed. Proofs from carob trees? Who's ever heard of such nonsense? He says, carob trees, you're right. What's a carob tree got to do with Torah? But after all, Torah is compared to water. So let this river prove my point. Immediately he said that, the current turned the other way and went backwards. They laughed even more. A country, a river he brings proofs from. Are you so intellectually bankrupt that that's all you can bring proofs from? Rivers and carob trees? We don't accept it. Imagine if the same person could do that. Make a carob tree jump 100 amos and make a river turn backwards. Can you imagine how much you would pay for brochas then? Goodness. And nobody came to Rabbi Elozer, nobody came seeking brochas from Rabbi Elozer after that. We don't see anything, he doesn't become a famous Rebbe after that at all. Totally unimpressed. You see from here, by the way, our whole approach, I'm saying this only half jokingly, we see our whole approach to miracle making. We don't make fun of it because we don't believe in it. We make fun of it because we do believe in it. Because it's so normal. It's so obvious that a Chochem can do this. There's no kunz. That's the Tivzor Omer V'Atokim Loch. Talmid Chochem, a Godel B'Torah, a Tzaddik, can decree and Hashem will obey. It's like the river go backwards, you want the Choruv tree to go. It doesn't impress us, it's nothing. It doesn't mean anything to us. On the contrary, a need to prove yourself by doing these miracles is an indication of bankruptcy. It's an indication of having nothing else. It shouldn't be necessary. Now he's getting a bit really frustrated. He says, right, now we'll come closer to home. You didn't want the carob tree, I understand. So I brought you a proof from water. Water's compared to Torah. You thought that was a bit too mystical too. Let's get closer, right into the Beis HaMedrash. I'll bring you proof from within the Beis HaMedrash. Let the walls of the Beis HaMedrash prove it. He took Kosley Beis HaMedrash Lipol. The walls started caving in. Now that becomes a serious issue because now there's some lives at stake. Go Abraham, Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua got up and shouted at the walls. What are you getting involved for? He says to the walls. The Talmidei Chachomim are having a discussion. What's it going to do with you? You stay where you are. So the walls didn't fall because that would have been a blow to the honor of Rabbi Yeshua. Nor did they stand up, because that would have been a blow to the dignity of Rabbi Eliezer. And still today, in this place, HaMedrash, the time the Gemara was written, you can go and see, and you'll see the walls set half caved in. They stopped where they were, and they didn't go any further. So he said, right, you don't now accept even from the walls of the Beis HaMedrash. How much closer can I get to an authority than that? Let God prove it. Forget the carob tree, forget the river, forget the Beis HaMedrash. I now appeal directly to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Let God prove it. Yotzeso Basko v'omro. Basko came out and said, a heavenly voice came and said, what are you arguing with Rabbi Eliezer? Don't you know that the halacha is always like Rabbi Eliezer? He's right. Omar Rabbi Yeshua Raglov. Rabbi Yeshua got up once again onto his feet. Omar, and he turned to the batkol and he waved his finger at it. And he said, don't you get involved either. The Torah is no longer in heaven. This is for us to decide, not for you to decide. And they took a decision against the Ribbono Shel Olam. God decided that Rabbi Eliezer was right, and they decided that they were right. And the psak was like them, not like Rabbi Eliezer. Ma'ilo b'shemaimi, what does that mean? Omar Rabbi Yirmiyah shekvar nitna Torah mi Har-Sinai, because Torah was already given at Har-Sinai. That's the principle we're looking at, that handing over of the Luchos to Moshe was not just handing over a body of literature. It was handing over an authority to be creative with that body of literature. And since that's been given, ein anu mashgichim bevasko, we are unimpressed with heavenly voices. Shekvar kosavto b'Har Sinai b'Torah, you have already said, Hashem, you yourself have written in that very Torah about which we're arguing, acharei rabim lahatus, that when talmidei chachomim, when scholars, when knowledgeable people are arguing a matter, the halacha is like the majority, and the majority is against Rabbi Eliezer, and you don't count. This is a human majority. God doesn't count in this counting of heads. Then there's a beautiful sequel. Ashkeche Rabbi Nosson Leliyo. Rabbi Nosson once found Rabbi Leliyo, which the Gemara also just tells casually. Rabbi Nosson found Leliyo Anovi, Elijah the prophet. Like it's an everyday occurrence, which for them it was. Omele, my Ovid Kuchubricha Bahai Shaisa. Says Rabbi Nosson, you're just the man I've been looking for. I've got to ask you, I'm bursting with curiosity. The day of this argument, when Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Yeshua and the Chachomim were arguing, and Rabbi Eliezer brought proofs from heaven that the halacha was like him, and we disproved him. What did the Ribbono Shel Olam do with that man? When he lost the fight with us, what did he do? Amale, says Eliyahu HaNavi, you know what Hashem was doing? Kochayich. There was a beautiful smile on his face. And he said, Nitzchuni bonai. My children have been victorious over me. They've won. And he was thrilled, just as a father would be thrilled when a child is able to overpower him with logic. And the father feels the growth and the development and the stature of his own child. So the Ribbono Shel Olam looks down with a smile on his face and says, Nitzchuni bonai. What religion, what philosophy in the world could picture such an event of God himself being overjoyed at the fact that the human being he has created has overpowered him with his own logic, so to say. Difficult to understand it all, but just to perceive it, to see it. Here we see that the power of that rabbinic logic, the power that has been entrusted into the Gedolei Yisrael, into the Chachmei Yisrael, by the Ribbono Shel Olam. The rabbinic power to be creative with the Torah, to overrule God himself, to the point, if necessary, of the destruction of the Luchos. But we still have this difficulty with Tosfos. That's all very well if the rabbinic logic is straight and good. But this poor attempt at rabbinic logic by an authority no less than Moshe Rabbeinu leaves one very troubled and disturbed. The Ikrim asks another question. And he gives an answer. The Ikrim's question is as follows. This is in the fourth section in Perek Tesvov. He's developing the concept that ha'odom mispoel yoser mehamurgash u'musag b'chush yoser mimash yispoel min ha'noido ba'amitus afal pishelo yisapek b'metziyusoy klal. No matter how certain a person is of knowledge, of information, he responds far more to sensual awareness than to intellectual awareness. The example I always give is, everybody knows it's dangerous to overtake or to break the speed limits or to go through red traffic lights or whatever, and there's no doubt, we don't question that information, we know it with absolute certainty, yet we do it. And when we see an accident where somebody's been hurt or killed for doing that very thing, we drive carefully for another few minutes. In a way that the knowledge of the rule doesn't make us drive carefully. When we see with our vision, our power of vision, we see the consequences of something, we react far more accurately, we modify our behavior far more quickly than by mere understanding of a concept. And he proves it this in the following way. Alitire Moshe Rabbeinu, ne'amar lo mipnei Hashem, bahor lech reid. Hashem says to Moshe, go down quickly. It's time to go back to the people now, because they've become degenerate, and they're serving idolatry. Hashem says that to Moshe. Moshe could not have doubted the truth of that statement in any way whatever. That was told to him by God, that the people were dancing around the golden calf. But he took the luchos with him. Why didn't he leave the tablets up there? It didn't enter his mind to leave them up on the mountain and not to take them down. When he came down and he saw the golden calf, chora apoy, then he got angry. Vayishalach miyado v'saluchos, he threw the luchos down, vayishaberes u'tachasahar, and he broke them at the foot of the mountain. Hareish nispor min haniru le'enayim v'nitztoy v'chora apoy, yosu mimash nispor min hanishmo. You see that he responded to what he saw far more drastically and with more anger than to what he knew, although he knew it with absolute certainty, since the authority with which he knew it was God himself. God says they're sitting, they're dancing around the golden calf, and he doesn't respond, he doesn't do anything. He takes the luchos with him. When he sees it with his own eyes, he gets angry and he shatters them. So you see the effect of vision. You see how much more we react to things we see than to things we merely know. That's a very nice piece of ikkun that just happens to be against the Gemara. The Gemara says it wasn't anger. The Gemara says it was a rabbinic deduction. He used logic. And he figured out that if there's one mitzvah, such as the Korban Pesach, which a Jew whose actions have estranged him from the value system of the Torah is not permitted to participate in, how much more so is he not permitted to participate in the whole Torah? If it's pure rabbinic logic and it's not emotionalism and it's not anger, then the Ikrim's question remains very powerful. So why did he bring them down in the first place? Why didn't he leave it? As soon as God said the people are serving idolatry, Moshe should have said, then I use my rabbinic authority, Ribbono Shel, take the luchos back. Keep them. Or I'll leave them here. I can't take them down. What's this business the Ikrim tells us? He knew and he understood that he took the luchos down and only broke them when he saw with his own eyes that they were actually dancing around the golden calf. Tosfos' question is an answer to this question. Tosfos says it wasn't the Kal Vachomer Gom. It wasn't a very good Kal Vachomer. The rabbinic logic wasn't very good. If the rabbinic logic wasn't very good, what was its purpose? The purpose was to teach Bnei Yisrael the principle. What is the principle? The principle is not that they are not allowed to participate in the Torah because they're dancing around the golden calf. The fact is, Moshe went back and got a second set, and he came and gave them, and he taught them to do tshuva. There was a way they could handle it. So Tosfos is right with his question. Surely this is a body of educational material which is needed all the more for deviant people than if they were okay. So he needs to bring it down to them. Notice Tosfos, this was not, the rabbinic logic was faulty. It's not the rabbinic logic which made him break the luchos. He wanted to teach them a principle. The principle was, there's something incongruous about what's happening. You can't be dancing around a golden calf when I bring the Torah. It just doesn't fit. Two don't go together. It's totally incongruous. Not because of the accurate rabbinic logic of a Kal Vachomer that since you're not allowed to participate in the mitzvahs of the Korban Pesach, you certainly wouldn't be allowed to learn the Torah. That's just, Tosfos is not valid. But there's a principle there. There's a value there. The value is that there are certain things that the Torah won't tolerate, where certain situations where the Torah doesn't tolerate incongruity. For a Ben Nechar to eat the Korban Pesach, the Torah won't allow that. Says Moshe, I'm using my rabbinic authority to declare that this too is incongruous, that I should come with the Torah and you should be dancing around the golden calf, that doesn't fit together. And so he breaks it. And so you will ask, but that's not the answer that the Ikrim gives. The Ikrim says Moshe got angry when he saw them, and he didn't get angry when God told him about it. And in my answer to that question, we have the basic principle of this entire shiur. And that is that incongruity is an aesthetic thing. Incongruity has to be judged by experience. Incongruity can't be judged intellectually. You can be told that they're dancing around the golden calf. That doesn't make it wrong to give them the Torah, as Tosfos says. And God doesn't say, break the Torah, don't give it to them. He says, go down quickly with the Torah to them. Knowledge, facts, information, nothing's incongruous. When you're dealing with scientific facts and with information, nothing's incongruous. It's only when you see them come together that you can look at the entire picture and say, this just doesn't fit, it's just not right. Doesn't fit. I give the example of a person who walks around with sandals, a man who walks around with sandals and with three-quarter length jeans, denim jeans, cut ruggedly at the bottom to make it look as if they're torn, not even cut, with patches all over them, an open neck shirt down to his belly button, and his tits is out. And you say to him, you know, looks a bit odd. And he says, so must I put my tzitzis in? There's a Mishnah Berurah that says you must wear the tzitzis out. What are you going to answer the man? He's right. There's a Mishnah Berurah which says you must wear the tzitzis out. What are you going to say? You're going to say that there's a Mishnah Berurah that says also that that's not the way to walk around? He'll say, and do you keep Kol HaTorah Kula? Do you keep everything? And just because there's one mitzvah that you don't keep, is that a reason not to keep anything? Do you want me to stop keeping Shabbos too? So you've got to say, no, you must keep Shabbos. So I must keep Shabbos, but I mustn't keep the mitzvah of my tzitzis out. Now go and explain that to me. What can you say to the man? You've got to say, but it looks idiotic. He'll say, to you it looks idiotic. To the Chofetz Chaim it wouldn't have looked idiotic, because he writes, you've got to wear your tzitzis out. So he'll answer. There's nothing to say to such a man. That's a question of an aesthetic sense of incongruity. It just doesn't go, it just doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. It's not right. There are certain things that go together and there are certain things that don't go together. And you can't discuss them theoretically. If you'd never seen such a man, and I described it to you, man walking with sandals, yarmulke on his head, I describe everything to you. It's frum, he might even have a beard, and I just is wearing his tzitzis up. In the description there's nothing incongruous. You're laughing because you can visualize it, because you can see the man, and you can see it's incongruous. But if you couldn't see it visually, if it was just a concept, you would say the same as he says. Intellectually, his argument is right. Just because I don't wear the clothes I'm supposed to wear, is that a reason not to keep the mitzvah tzitzis properly? Intellectually, he's right. It's just meshuggah, that's all. It's just imbalanced. So he says, where does it say in the Torah that this is meshuggah? Where's the halachic concept of meshuggah? Meshuggah is a shaita, a person who's lost his mind. Have I lost my mind? Do you think I'm an irrational being? No, you're not. So how can you call me meshuggah? So I can't call you. You can't argue with him. You either have that sense or you don't have that sense. When the facts were placed before Moshe Rabbeinu intellectually up on the mountain, there was nothing to aggravate him. Good, yes, they're serving idolatry, that's a terrible thing. I better get down as quickly as possible and teach them this Torah and get them going. When he comes and he sees it, he just realizes, I can't. This I can't do. So take this Torah, on Yom Matan Torah, on the day of giving of the Torah, to a nation is dancing around the golden calf. Doesn't go. Can't do it. So what we see here is that the rabbinic authority that we're talking about is not just a halachic rabbinic authority such as we see in Bava Metzia between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, that when there's a matter of intellectual argument, that there are certain rules that we follow, and when those rules lead us to conclusions, we bind ourselves and we bind God by those conclusions too. Here we're going further and we're saying that the Gedolei Yisrael have the right to interpret and to apply the Torah and to bend it, so to say, to make it congruous. Even if it doesn't, even there's no specific proof you can bring for that. Moshe's got no proof on the basis of this process. The Kal Vachomer which the Gemara brings is a weak Kal Vachomer. It illustrates a principle, it doesn't illustrate the detail. The principle, yes, but the detailed halachic reasoning is faulty. What's not faulty is that it is incongruous. That Matan Torah can't go together with dancing around the golden calf. Even though halachically you could explain it, aesthetically it doesn't fit. It's incongruous, it's crazy, it's absurd. And we cannot have Torah operating in an environment of absurdity. Torah has to operate in an environment of normality. And the moment there's an absurdity in the environment, Torah cannot flourish. It's not Torah. Then you start moving carob trees and turning water backwards, then you can do all the mystical things. But if there's an environment, that you can do if there's an environment of absurdity. If there's an environment of normality, then Torah can flourish in the proper way. And Moshe feels this can't work. To take Torah to Klal Yisrael in this situation, that cannot work. He's got to fix Klal Yisrael first, do tshuva, and then go back onto the mountain to try and re-establish the luchos. The second case the Medrash brings, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omar Lo Shiyilochem in Tzichrei. Hashem told Moshe to fight against Tzichrei. Shenema, as it says, Hasgeir Bo Milchama. Make war with him, Milchama. And he didn't do that. He sent messengers to Sichon to try and make peace. Hashem says go to war, Moshe sues for peace. Can you imagine anything so opposite? It's as opposite. Hashem gives him a Torah, he destroys the Torah. Hashem says make war, he makes peace. Where does he get the authority for it from? And not only that, but we find Hashem accepts it. I told you to fight them. The Atah Pesachta B'Sholem, and you opened in peace.
You're right. From now on, that's how it will be.
In any war into which you engage, you will always sue for peace first. You always offer them the option of peace before you go to war. So Hashem modifies his instruction on the basis of Moshe's chidush. Moshe's mechadish. Moshe comes with a creative idea for which he appears to have no apparent authority. God says go to war. He asks for peace. And God says, good thing, good idea. In future we'll do it your way, Moshe. Another example that the Medrash brings of Vatigzor Omer Vayokim Lach, where Moshe, the tzaddik, can decree and Hashem will obey. Hashem says go to war. Moshe says that's not the way to do it. We start with peace for it. Hashem says you're right. Let's do it that way. Where does Moshe get it from? He understands the principle of war. The principle of war is to achieve peace. The principle of war is not to destroy. The purpose of war is to achieve peace. And war is a last resort. And one needs the capacity to fight in order to ensure that there's peace. And I've felt very worried about the decline of the power of Russia over the last 12 months or so. Because one power doesn't stay strong. If there's only one world power, it will start weakening. Because it's got no challenge. And if it has no challenge, it doesn't strengthen itself. And immediately they started cutting their defense budgets and started limiting their war capability. When there's nobody with the capacity to fight, you cannot have peace. You can only have peace when there are people with the capacity to fight. And that's why Hashem oiz l'amu yitein. Hashem gave his nation oiz, strength, power. Then, once he's given them power, Hashem yavorech es amu v'sholem. Hashem blessed his people with peace. You can't have peace if there isn't power. I was counseling a couple this week. And I said to the man, he couldn't understand, one of these cases, he couldn't understand why his wife wanted to walk out. I said, have you ever asserted yourself? Have you ever said no? He would never say no. Why should he say no? She can have whatever she wants. He loves her so much. And now she wants to still walk out on him. I said, but don't you understand that's why she wants to walk out on you? And she's busy nodding her head vigorously. And eventually he said, you know, I was taught that you get married for shalom bayis, for peace. You're telling me I'm supposed to be assertive, and they're both strong-willed people. You're telling me I'm supposed to be assertive. We'll have an argument. I said, of course you'll have an argument. And the result of the argument will be respect and peace. He says, no, that I'm not prepared to. I want peace in my home. I'm not prepared to get involved in arguments. I said, and what happens if you see? Your wife was nodding her head when I said she wants you to be assertive. He said, then I must divorce her. I said, oh, first time you've been assertive. First time at least you've been assertive. There has to be a capacity to fight. If a person is not willing to walk out on a situation, if a person is not willing to fight for the situation, they cannot be shalom. A husband who has to plead with his wife is not going to have shola if he's not willing to take the risks of doing what he believes is right. A husband has to get permission from his wife to come to a shir, and if she says no, then to ask your wife for permission to come to shir is fine. That's very diplomatic. That's good politics. And for the wife occasionally to say no is also good politics, to see what happens now. And for the husband to give in, it doesn't gain him any respect and it doesn't gain him any love. At the end of the day, they can only be sholem when each one knows that what is important to the other will be fought for. A parent needs to know that, a child needs to know that with a parent too. At the point at which a parent will fight, where he won't allow it. And then respect can develop. Only when there's oiz can there be sholem. So Moshe Rabbeinu says the purpose of war is sholem. If the purpose of the battle is to have peace, surely we must give them the option of peace first. Now of course the only way they might take up that option is if they have fear. If they're afraid of us, they might take up the option. But give them the option. Says the Rabbeinu Shalom, you're right. That's straight logic, understanding the principle and realizing that the purpose of war is not to do the other side in, but to bring about a status of peace. And if you can bring about that situation of peace without the war, so much the better, as long as you have the capacity to fight. You can only try for peace if you're ready for the consequences. If they say, no, we don't go for peace, then you've got to be ready to walk in. You can't keep on threatening and threatening and threatening. Like a parent with a child, if you touch that, I'm going to smack you. Child touches it. I said I was going to smack you. Child touches it again. I told you that if you touch it, I'm going to smack you. The usual example. And so it goes on. Each time he says it, the child thinks to himself subconsciously over and over again, what a cowardly liar my parent is. Cowardly liar. Not afraid to lie to me, and too afraid to touch me. That's who my parents are. And I've got to respect them, the Torah says. Funny Torah this, isn't it? Respect them? Them? They're scared of me, little guy. And they're scared of me. Would they stand up to anybody else? If some robber walked into the house, could you imagine this weakling of a father standing up to him? This is no father, this is no man. There's no covered at all. They cannot be covered if there isn't the will and the capacity to fight if peace doesn't work. You try with peace first, and if peace doesn't fight, you've got to be ready for the battle, and you've got to be able to win the battle. And so Moshe goes with peace first, and Hashem approves. Hashem says that's correct. We don't have time now to go into an analysis of the second part of that Midrash, the part that we've just learned, although it's no less fascinating than the first part. But just to dwell for another minute or two on the general concept. The general concept is the obligation of mankind to apply Torah into a real situation. We've talked about that also recently over recent weeks. The importance not to turn Torah into something academic, into something so rigid that it cannot work. Life is flowing, life is dynamic, life is continually changing. The principles of the Torah can't change. The value system of the Torah can't change. The logic system of the Torah can't change. But yet it's got to continually be applied to life in a congruous way, not in an incongruous way. To see people applying Torah to life compulsively, that we're seeing all the time. A fellow who walks around the Torah reading his walks around the street reading his sefer, bumping into the pole as he goes, bumping into people as he goes, and you say, excuse me, Meshuggah, what are you walking around reading a sefer? He says, don't you know it says in the Torah you mustn't waste a minute? You're going to be learning all the time? What are you going to argue with such a person? He's right. And I've got to walk, you know, every day I spend an hour walking to the bus, from the bus, back to the bus, off the bus, an hour a day. That's 30 hours a month. Do you realize what I can do in 30 hours a month? I can cover a mesechta a month by learning while I walk. And you're telling me not to learn while I walk? What are you going to say to him? It's all very nice. The halacha is right. The rationale is right. If we were arguing academically, you're right. It just happens to look mad. It's just incongruous. It's just not the way to deal with people. You bump into people, you look odd, you don't. It's not right. It's necessary to apply Torah, to make Torah work in a congruous way. It's got to fit. It's got to remain authentic. It's got to remain untouched. And yet it's got to feel natural. It's got to look natural. It's got to fit. And that is the role of Psak. That is really the role of the application of Torah into a contemporary civilization, into a contemporary society. remember two cases that will always stand in my mind. The one was where I had a few very difficult shailas that I was discussing with Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and I was trying to nail him down and to get him to give me an answer. I knew that he was at the end of his life, and he died only a few weeks later, and I knew that after his death there was nobody else that would take upon himself the psak of such shailas. You're developing a fine sense of drama, Nevin. And he wouldn't let himself get nailed down. And eventually he came back to me very firmly. And he said, I will give you the principles, and you will make the decisions. You're on the spot, I'm not on the spot. And if you're a Rov, your shoulders have to be wide enough to take the responsibility yourself. And to me, that was the finest of all the smichas I ever got. But much more than that was a teaching to me of the most important role of the Rov. Not to make academic decisions which somebody 5,000 miles away can make just as well. At the end of the day, you see how it fits. It's not just an academic decision. You know the principles. But the application of the principles can't be made unless you see how it fits. You've got to decide. And it must have been within a few months that I was discussing an equally serious but very different shaila with Rav Shach. And his answer to me was very similar. He said, you're not just a Rav, you're an educator. And in every decision you make, you've got to decide what long-term effect will that decision have on the Yiddishkeit of the person for whom you're paskening and your community. And I can't help you with that, he said. The understanding that a psak is not just an academic decision, this is what the halacha is and finished. One has to know what the halacha is, one has to have the academic decision clear in one's mind. But that's not the difficulty, that's relatively easy. And that, if you can't do yourself, that other people qualified who can do for you. That's not the difficult part. The difficult part is when you've got the principles and you understand, to decide about the congruity. How does it really fit? How do you apply it? How do you make it work in a sensible way, in a practical way, in a way that is normal, in a way that will develop, in a way that will remain dynamic? And it's this dynamicism of Torah which ensures its integrity. The Rambam says at the beginning of the ninth perek of Hilchos Yisoidei HaTorah, Dovar Borur Mefurosh Batoiro. It is clear and explicit in the Torah, Shehi Mitzvah Omedes La'olam La'olmei Olami, that it is a system that will apply forever and ever and ever. Ein lo loy shinui v'loy giroin v'loy tisefes. There will be no change, no detraction, and no addition. You see from various psukim that he brings that all the words of the Torah are binding on us forever. And likewise he says, the Torah says, Chukas Olam L'Doyrei Seichem, this is a law forever for all your generations. The Ne'emar, and it says, Lo b'shamayim hi. He brings the same pasuk that we had in the case of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. This is not in Shamayim. That's a strange pasuk to bring. That would seem to indicate the opposite in a sense. That lo b'shamayim means that man has got control, and if man has got control, it can change. What does the Rambam bring? Lo b'shamayim hi, that the Torah is no longer in heaven as proof that it's forever and ever. Holomadatu, you see from that pasuk, she'ein novi roshay l'chadesh dovo me'ata, that nobody can make anything up. But it says lo b'shamayim hi, it's not in heaven. On the contrary, maybe a novi can make up. If the Torah would have been given as it was in heaven, and we would not have been allowed to apply it, it would have been necessary to be creative, to be original, never mind creative, to actually change the Torah. Because as life has changed over the times and will continue to change over the times, there's no way that we could adjust to something which is totally static. Lo b'shamayim hi is the principle built into the Torah to make it able to retain its integrity and its authenticity 100% and yet be applied with normality. That's the incredible thing about Torah. That in each generation, from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu until today, B'nai Torah can live and be part of a changing world. But it doesn't affect them. They don't have to look odd and incongruous. They can be part of that changing world. And the fact that sometimes, regrettably, B'nai Torah do look odd and incongruous, I need to point out frequently, is not because the Torah is odd and incongruous, it's because the people are odd and incongruous. That's not a fault in the Torah. And I gave you the example, I think only a week or two ago, of how non-Jews used to stand up when a person like the Pono Vizhurov used to walk into the room. He also used to wear a long coat and a big black hat, and he had a beard, but he had majesty. That didn't detract. That doesn't mean you have to look odd. It doesn't mean you have to look crazy. That Goyim, my father tells, used to line the streets in Kovno when the Kovnarov used to go for his walk every afternoon, just to see him, catch a glimpse of him. And today also, when one sees the true Gedolei Yisrael, they don't look odd. They don't look crazy. They don't look like there's a screw loose. They don't bump into people. They don't walk down the road reading. They don't do that. They're normal human beings. They're great human beings. They're incredibly great human beings. And one sees that greatness and one is awe-inspired by that greatness. But one doesn't notice oddity. One doesn't notice them as if they're misfits. So when one sees a religious misfit, it's not because he's religious. He would have been a misfit no matter what he was doing. One has to understand that there are misfits in every society, and in religious society it's no different. It's not the Torah which makes the misfits. The Torah, there's no reason for the Torah to make anybody a misfit. On the contrary, that's the unbelievable thing, that the Torah has built into it a system able to retain adaptability without one iota of adulteration, without one iota of compromise. That one can remain normal in every situation without compromising the Torah and yet being able to apply it. There's a difference between application and compromise. The Torah needs to be applied. The Torah may never be compromised. If the Torah were not able to be applied, it would have to be compromised. It's because Leib Shemaimi, it's because Torah is no longer in heaven, it's been given to us to apply. And in what way do we apply it? We use two methods. The one is our rabbinic reasoning, as we had in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, and the argument between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, where the power of intellect, using the systems of the Torah, provided one's qualified to do so, may lead one to conclusions which are new and revolutionary. And we're bound by those conclusions, and so is God bound by those conclusions. And the second way is in making it congruous, to make sure that even after we've applied it, there's congruity. The luchos cannot be given to a nation that are dancing around the golden calf. One cannot go to war before one has tried for peace. One cannot walk around the streets with three-quarter cut denim jeans and sandals and an open-neck shirt and one's tits is flapping in the wind. One cannot do that. Although it's got nothing to do with rabbinic reasoning, it's got to do with a sense of normality, with a sense of congruity. That's the beauty of how the Torah needs to be applied. That sense of congruity needs to be there. And that is the function of the Torah scholars of each generation, to analyze the Torah, to apply the Torah, to project the Torah, and to ensure that the Torah is applied with integrity and authenticity on the one hand, and with normality and congruity on the other hand. And that's the Vetigzer Oymer Vayokim Lach that Eev is told. That Eev, you never have to feel yourself as a function of your environment. Eev, you never have to feel yourself as being out of control of your environment. On the contrary, Vatigzor Oime, Hashem has made man so powerful, he has given him such brilliance of intellect, such purity of soul, that he has been willing to entrust him with a Torah even to the point of allowing him, Chas v'Sholem, to shatter those luchos, if necessary. He has been willing to entrust man with that Torah. To entrust him with that Torah means, as we said, not to entrust him merely with a body of literature, but to entrust him with a system of divine logic, with a system of divine rationale, in which he is instructed, which is permitted and indeed instructed, to be creative and to be dynamic. He's given him a soul, an ability to intuitively sense what fits and what doesn't, so that even when one analyzes something rationally, it might appear right. When one looks at it visually, as the Ikrim sees, it doesn't fit. And God has entrusted the Tzadikei Ador, the righteous people of the generation, with the art of judgment, what fits and what doesn't. And God has allowed himself to be bound by the decisions of these great people.